Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a father and daughter who are passionate about sport and who each have made their own contribution to sporting life. Liam Mulvihill is originally from County Longford, an inter-county footballer in his youth. He was Director General of the GAA from 1979 until his retirement 4 years ago. He shepherded the organisation through a period of great change, including the redevelopment of Croke Park. His daughter Doronia grew up in County Meath. As a teenager, she loved GAA and cross-country running, but her life changed when she contracted meningitis and complications of the illness resulted in both her legs being amputated. This summer, she was one of the presenters of Channel 4 Television's London Paralympic Games programmes. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy yourself in London, Doronia? You were great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. No, I had a brilliant time. It was such an experience, and to have been there during the Paralympics and the Olympics was just something pretty special, because it felt in one way like a home games. A lot of Irish people said that when they came over, it was so close and there was some atmosphere there. It was great to be part of it.
Were you nervous when you knew she was going to be doing this big gig, Liam?
Well, we weren't sure, you know, but the minute she said that she had the opportunity, we said go for it. She saw on the internet that Channel 4 were interested in taking on some inexperienced people who had disabilities to be involved, and Doronia expressed an interest, and the minute that Maura and myself discussed it, we immediately said to her, this is something you should go for.
I like the use of the word inexperience. What they said was they wanted people who maybe had a disability and an interest in working in television and an interest in sport. And I just thought, well, that's me. That's exactly my three areas. So I said, sure, I'll go for it. And yeah, they were happy to take on people who hadn't an awful lot of experience. So it was a great opportunity. Seemed like the right time and the right thing for me. It really did.
Because you were already working in here, weren't you, for a few years in RTE? So it was in your blood already, in a sense.
Yeah, I'd been in RTE for 5 years and I loved it here, still do. But it was great to have that experience, because I think having worked behind the scenes and written the scripts and done all the research, it really helps you then when you're the one doing the interviews. You know what it's like and you know what you need to know.
Were you nervous at all? You didn't look nervous at all.
It was less nerves and more adrenaline, because live sport is just, you just don't know what's around the corner. And with the Paralympics, there were 20 live sports. So at any time, we didn't really know exactly where we were going to go and what we were going to do. And a lot of the time, they were counting down 10, 9, 8. And then suddenly they changed their minds. It's like, we don't have that footage. We don't have that footage. Just talk.
And it was
just talk. So it was great experience to get all that, you know, especially not having done an awful lot before.
I mean, all those games obviously are impressive, but in the Paralympics, which particular aspect of it were you most impressed by?
I loved the amputee high jump, because there were these men with one leg hopping towards the high jump and then launching themselves backwards over it with not a care in the world. And I just thought, fair play to them, watching them do that. And it just, I think, really encapsulated the spirit of the Paralympics. It doesn't matter what your disability is, you just go out there and you try to be the best at what you do. And they were jumping some phenomenal jumps.
Do you think it made it extra special for you because you yourself, I suppose, had and have a disability? Does it make it more special?
It does, because I guess sometimes you feel you're on your own when you've a disability. None of my family or none of my friends have one similar to me. So in one way, it was refreshing to be surrounded by so many people with such varying degrees of disability. You know, some people, it's very slight, and for some people it's very pronounced. But especially for me, seeing the likes of Oscar Pistorius and Johnny Peacock, who are the amputees, and seeing them run. As you mentioned, I was a runner before I got my illness, and seeing them, there's nothing stopping them. They put on the blades and they train so hard, because I had a chance to try out them blades, and they're very difficult to run on.
Yeah, are they? I was wondering that.
Oh, yeah. They're so hard. It's not like running like the way you would normally. You have to really condition your whole body to be able to run in them. The stance that you take when you're on them is your knees are bent. bent. So naturally your body bends over, but you have to pull yourself back using your stomach muscles and your shoulder muscles. And that's just standing on them. To run is even more difficult, and it takes a lot. They told me that if they're off the blades for 3 or 4 days, they almost have to learn from scratch again. It's very difficult. And they're there running times like Oscar Pistorius ran in the Olympics.
I know, he's extraordinary.
He really is. Yeah.
Is it something you ever thought about doing when you were younger?
Using the running blades?
No, just getting involved yourself almost in Paralympic sports.
It was something Dad will remember. It was something that I did talk about when I was in hospital, because my friends came in to me and said one day, really excited, because they were the same as me. They didn't know what the future would hold for me. And they had seen some Olympians running. This was before Oscar Pistorius was on the scene, but they'd seen them on the blades. And they came in and said, you're going to be able to run again. We've seen these people on these running blades, it's so exciting. So we joked about the fact that I'd be going off to school not with my tracksuit over my back and a bag, but these running legs over my back. But it just never happened. I had extra problems. I had problems with my bones and my knees, and they're expensive to get those legs, and it's sometimes difficult enough to just get the basic walking legs. So I just never got a chance to try them until this summer.
But for someone like you, Liam, who I suppose is steeped in sport, you were an inter-county player yourself, when you look at something like Paralympians, they are kind of extraordinary people, aren't they?
Well, they are. You have to admire them to such an extent. And it is real sport. There was a time when people thought that the Paralympics, if you like, was on a different level than the top level sport. But it has been taken to a different level now. There's no doubt about it. As Dorania said, they cross over. The fact that people who are Paralympic athletes are there or thereabouts, and we have our own Jason Smith as well, who isn't far off the able-bodied people. So it's marvellous to see that, and you have to admire them. And I think anyone who's has a feeling for sport will have to appreciate the Paralympic sport, because it's not just about sport, but it's really, in the true sense, is about bravery and everything that we talk about in sport.
Were you very proud when you saw Dorania doing the Paralympics? Because I suppose yourself and Maura is your wife, isn't it? You would have worried about her a lot.
We were proud, to be honest. Yes, we were. But the main reason we would have worried when she was going for the Paralympics, strangely, was about London, just being away from home and in a different environment. And London isn't an easy city to get around. That hasn't been easy for her, but she has managed to cope, and we're delighted for her. It's another step along the way. Goodness knows what the future will hold, but we're very confident that she's going to get whatever she wants to do, because that's her nature.
Well, something I have noticed about London is when you're at home, you know that if there is a problem, that there's a load of people just a phone call away. But London, that's just not there. I have an uncle there, but not my mom and dad and my brothers and most of my good friends. Like Dad said, the tubes and the transport does get me tired, and I'm the type of person, I don't like not to be able to do things. I don't like having a disability to get in the way. I was as I was till I was 16, and I feel like I should be the same now. So it's hard sometimes when you realise, do you know what, I do actually just have to take a bit of a break.
I suppose the other thing about London is it's so big and you're anonymous there. But I suppose here, because you're yourself and you're Liam Mulvihill's daughter, it probably a lot of people would even know you, because the GAA is such a big family. In London, though, nobody would know that connection.
That was one reason why I sort of stayed away from sport a little bit when I first came out of college, because I did communications in college and I knew I wanted to work in television. But when I first went in, I worked on a GAA programme and I just felt I was ringing everybody as guests who I knew. So it was nice to go away and just make up my own contacts and do my own work. And then when I went to London, sure, I said, oh, my favourite sport is GAA, and they looked at me going, what's that? Do you know, you think everybody knows it, but they don't. But in a way that was good, because nobody knew who I was, so nobody could say, oh, sure, she's just doing that job because of her, who her dad is.
And obviously for your family, Liam, the story of what happened to Dorania, you all know it so well, and you're probably weary even thinking about it. But for many people listening this morning, Do you mind telling them what did happen to Dorania?
Well, I think Dorania herself would be able to explain it better than I can, but she got meningitis and developed septicemia.
Can I come in there for a moment? You know, people always get warned about meningitis. Mm. How did you first know Dorania even had meningitis?
That morning she woke up and said that she had bad headache, and she talked about having a nightmare during the night and described very vividly the nightmare that she had. And, you know, we said, this sounds like a high temperature and something that needs to be looked into. And Maura did call the doctor, and the doctor came, I think, twice during the course of the day. In the afternoon at about, I would say about half 2 or 3 o'clock, Maura rang me at work and she said, I think you should come home. She's not any better, and we're worried. And by the time I got home, it was getting dark. It was around half five, I would say. Maura did speak about meningitis almost immediately. She was she twigged it very, very quickly. To be quite honest, I wasn't aware of the.
That's great.
Of what the symptoms were. At the same time, it was only when Dorania actually got out of bed to go to the bathroom, and it had got dark at this stage, or relatively dark, and she turned on the light and she noticed spots on her hand. Blotches, and immediately then Maura rang the doctor and said, "This, I'm afraid it is meningitis." And so the doctor said, "Look, don't wait, just ring the hospital. Don't wait for an ambulance. Just get her there as quickly as possible."
I didn't realise it was so serious. Mum describes it as every mother's nightmare, which you hear a lot of people say. And I think that's why she was so concerned about it on the day. And as soon as she saw the spot, she just said her heart stopped, because then she knew that's what it was. But I didn't. I didn't know how bad it was. And I just walked out to the car, and I remember going into the hospital. And by the time we got to the hospital, it was about 15, 20 minutes to get there. The spots had gone from being on my hand to being going up my legs and up my arms as well. So they were almost growing in front of my eyes. But I remember, because I was just gone 16 at the time, all I was worried about was I had to wear my mom's slippers, because we couldn't find my slippers in the rush out the door. And I was saying to all the doctors, do you know, they're not my slippers now, they're my mom's slippers. And sure, they didn't even care. That was the least of their worries. But that just shows what I was thinking about. And then they brought me up for an MRI scan, and they said, I just looked at them and said, look, when can I go home? I just want to go home. And they said, it's going to be a while. And within a few hours, I was in intensive care and isolation and in a medically induced coma, because the meningitis, the strain I got was very severe. And one by one, all my organs started shutting down. And they asked Mam to get Dad to come in and to get another family member to come in to support them. And then to bring my brothers in to say goodbye, because they said I wouldn't live that night. So it was very sudden. I remember when Dad came home from work that evening, it was Pancake Tuesday. Mm. And I remember shouting down, going, Dad, I'm so sick, I didn't even eat pancakes. And I just didn't. And I was fine. I was chatting with them. And then suddenly they were telling them to bring in my brothers to say goodbye. That's how quick it was.
I remember that day very well. And I remember that night as well, even more, particularly, you know, the loneliness of being in a hospital waiting room in the middle of the night. And by this stage, we could no longer see Dorania. She had been taken away into the intensive care area, and we were just kept there at a distance, and just getting a report every hour or two. But it was one of those memories you don't lose, something which is so indelible as to happen to you as that, you know.
But it must almost be unreal or surreal that your daughter, who when you left for work that morning seemed you know, perfect. Mm. In your mind, she was perfect. Mm. And then by that night...
And actually, what made it harder, I suppose, was that we had been a lucky family. And you know the way you have that with some families, that none of them had ever had a serious illness. And they all had no problem at school. They had got on well and they were interested in sport. And just everything seemed to fall into place. And then, bang, something like this happens. And it does set you back, and it sends you back to first principles, and you either have faith or you don't at a time like that. And it's a tester for everyone, for all the family. And the youngest of the family was only
nine
at the time, eight going on nine, and the boy who was 11 or 12, he was old enough that we could explain to him what was happening, and he was very interested in asking questions. But the younger boy got very little in the line of information, and it's something that we regretted afterwards, that we felt he was too young to be...
You were protecting him, right?
We were protecting him, we felt, but we felt in retrospect it might have been better to have given him more information. But that's one of the things it's very difficult in the midst of something like that just to think of all the angles, as it were.
Well, obviously, go on, you were saying.
I was just going to say, I was in intensive care for 8 weeks, and it was in a medically induced coma all that time. So for me, a lot of people say to me, how did you cope? But it wasn't me that had to cope, it was my family. And not only were they having to see me so sick and not being able to wake up or communicate with them, but they had to go out and deal with all the relations and family and friends and everyone who's being so supportive, but still they had to go out and make chat with them all day outside the hospital room. Mm-hmm. And Dad was back in Crow Park working, and Mum and Dad ended up getting a room in the hospital in the Mater to stay there, because they just needed to be there all the time. So for them it was almost like life came to a standstill. Mm-hmm. For me it's like 8 weeks of my life that just didn't exist. So it was a very different experience for me than what it was for everybody else.
Was it the first night they came in and said to prepare yourself that she wasn't going to make it?
Oh, it was quite early on that night. Looking back on it all, that was straightforward. But what wasn't straightforward was trying to get answers after that. And the whole question was the extent of the loss of limb that was going to be involved. And we kept asking questions, and the doctors wouldn't give us answers. And in fairness, they probably didn't know themselves how things were going to turn out. But that was a very hard period. And even right down to the stage when she was several months, almost a year after the whole thing had hit her, her knees, one of her knees had been giving particular problems, and the doctors wanted to amputate one of the knees. And Moira insisted that she was going to manage to hold on to the knee.
Good for Moira. She was like determined.
That's right.
She was the fighter a lot of the time. And she was the one who pulled me out of bed, because I would have been happy out just lying in bed and not doing anything.
And is it true also that she was almost stronger than you were, Liam, when they wanted you to sign the form about getting Daronia's legs amputated? You found it too difficult to sign that form?
Yes, and the same with her fingers when they came. We had discussed it, and we felt it was going to have to be done, but I hadn't realised they would ask us to sign the consent form. And when they put the consent form before us, I said, I'm not going to sign up to that. How am I going to explain to Daronia that I agreed that her limbs had to be removed? And Maura said, well, if you don't sign it, I'm going to sign it, because we want to keep her alive. So she took it on herself and signed it. That was on St. Patrick's Day of that year. I remember it was the most beautiful St. Patrick's Day I can remember. It actually was a summer's day. It was so warm, and we were outside in the hospital grounds discussing it, and Maura said, look, this just has to be done. I'm going to put my name to it.
Why did you find it so difficult, Liam?
Well, your daughter or your son is part of yourself, and even though you know deep down medically that it has to be done. At the same time, I just said, why just don't they do it? And why do they want me to say yes to it? There's a stubborn streak in me, I suppose, that I just didn't feel that it was necessary and that I should be asked to do it. But anyhow,
it's probably counterintuitive, isn't it? Because everything in your DNA as a parent is to protect your child.
That's true. I suppose that's the reason. But Maura saw it differently, as protecting her, as far as she was concerned, was let's get this done and she's going to recover from it. That was Maura's attitude.
Well, she was right, because I think you would have died if you hadn't, I think. Would you like?
I know, I think it was just the symbol of it, because like I said, running was really what I did. That 4 nights a week, that's what I did. The other nights I played basketball and camogie. And I think the thing is that Dad knew that I was going to survive, but I wouldn't be the same girl. I wouldn't be able to do what I was able to do. Mm. And at that stage, doctors were saying to them that I wouldn't have a normal life again. And there weren't many other examples for us to be able to compare it to know that that wasn't the truth, to know that there are other options out there. For me, I wasn't awake when they did the leg operation, but I was when they did the finger operation. And I think when you lose your legs, you can get prosthetic legs and you can walk. It's not that difficult. But the hands are quite different, because hands are very visual. You see them in front of you. And my hands had gone black because the meningitis and septicemia had the tissue had died. But I still had little bits of nail varnish on the tips of my nails from when I first went in. And I thought they'd be able to save the fingers. I really did. And they couldn't. They did manage to save the palms of my hands, which at the time I didn't know what that meant. But actually, it's given me an ability to do most things. You know, I can't move my fingers. I have prosthetic hands. I can't move the fingers, but because I have the palms of my hands, I can move the hands. So I can do things. I can carry things. I can do everything. There's not really anything I can't do, which is brilliant. But for me at 16, it was a difficult thing to process. All I fed off was the information and the way that Mum and Dad and my friends and family treated me, and they just treated me normally, and that was great, because then all I wanted to do was get back into normal life.
And also, I'm sitting here looking at your hands now. I would never know they're not your fingers. So I don't know who did the job, but it's amazing. You've got beautiful hands. No, it is amazing.
And you know, they're not the most high tech or high quality or anything. They're just cosmetic, really, more than anything else.
She has had no major problem. Just small things like a lot of door keys are difficult to put into a door and to take out. Yeah. And she has problems with some areas like that, or taking a coin out of a handbag.
Coins is the worst. If you take your hands and if you freeze the fingers but your hands can move, that's exactly what I can do. Yeah. So you just find a way of doing everything by not actually moving the fingers. But they're still there, so you can do things like type and use a phone and text. It's just about learning.
I have to get the first piece of music, which is so interesting. I just want to ask you one thing. Like, for instance, when you meet people in London now, at what stage do you ever tell people?
It's a difficult thing, but a lot of people will shake your hand when they first meet you, and then you can see by the reaction on their face that they know, okay, something's going on here. But you don't want to just say it, because then it's awkward. It's more about just letting it happen naturally, I think.
May I tell the story about university?
What was that?
When she was in the university, she was late for a sort of a discussion group, and another student said to her, "They're on you. You're late." And he looked at her as she was coming up towards him, and he was a year and a half with her in the class at this stage. He said, "You're walking with a limp as well," and she said, "Oh, I have a sore leg." And his friends told him afterwards that she had prosthetic limbs, and he was just so shocked.
He said, "What are you walking with a limp? What were you doing last night?" Almost giving out to me. He didn't know. But that's great. And I don't think everybody needs to know.
No.
Do you know, it's just if you're going to be in direct contact with somebody, then, you know, it's nice when your friends and family and the people with you know. So if you need help with something, that you can ask them in a natural way. And most of my friends say they forget of a disability.
Yeah.
It's not even something that they think of when they think of me, and that's brilliant. And we talked about the Paralympics earlier. I think that shows it again. I think a lot of people were watching the sport and then suddenly they go, oh my gosh, I forgot they were in wheelchairs, because they're just following the sport. And when that moment happens, when people forget the aid or whatever it is that they have, then that's something powerful, I think.
Listen, we're going to take the first piece of music, which is The Corrs.
Yes, this is The Corrs' Runaway. And The Corrs were my favourite band when I was in hospital, and very, very nicely. They were lovely, lovely people. They came in to visit me in hospital. They heard that I loved them and they performed this song and a few other songs for me. So this is Runaway by The Corrs.
Do you mean by the side of your bed?
By the side of my bed. The nurses, the doctors, especially the student doctors, were all clamouring into the room to try and listen to them. And they were brilliant. They were as good a cappella as they are on stage.
And I would run away.
Corrs, great song there, Runaway. You love that song when you were in hospital. One thing I was thinking during that song, Liam, was, were you ever worried at any stage that the meningitis, when she was in the coma for 8 weeks, would affect her brain?
Oh, it was very much a worry, and the doctors did say that to us, that it's very common with the meningitis that there is brain damage.
I did well in school, and it was part of what I did, as well as the sport. So just to be able to get back and to be getting the same grades and to do as well as my friends in the Leaving Cert.
You were very serious though at school. You did work hard. I wish the boys had to work half as hard as you did. I think all parents have that experience.
Boys never do.
We still had the issues though coming up to the Junior Cert. Like, you're not doing your work, get sit down and do your work, but I never found it a chore. I enjoyed it, and so it was nice to be able to go back and do that. I do need to be challenged with things, and in a way, when you go through something like that, you have to just use the mental side and just dig deep and say, right, what's happened? This has happened. What's next? And you just have to make a plan for yourself and go down a road. And you need to have your mind working properly for that, because you can go down in the dumps really sometimes very easily. And you just need to say to yourself, look, this has happened. Yes, but it could be a lot worse. And you have to remind yourself of that sometimes, because sometimes you can feel a bit low about things, you know.
Ron, you did mention the school, and I think everyone in Colossae has gone, right from the principal right down to the cleaners in the school. They all more or less adopted her, and they were so good to her that the support that she got from everyone there was marvellous.
Well, that's a lovely tribute to the school. Where did you grow up? Tell me about your background, Liam.
Well, I grew up in a rural part of County Longford. Keena is the name of the parish. Close to Ballymahon would be the town that most people would recognise, Goldsmith, the country. Had a very happy childhood there. Went to school in Ballymahon to primary school, then went to boarding school because I was the eldest of, I'm not sure when I went to boarding school how many were in the family there. It ended up with 10 anyhow. Mm-hmm. And so I was sent to St. Mel's in Longford, which would be the nearest boarding school.
What's it like being the eldest of 10?
I think it's very difficult. I always say it's difficult. I know the people who have studied families say that the eldest and the youngest in families tend to get on the best. But from my point of view, the eldest was a groundbreaker all the way. Times were hard enough for farming families when I was growing up. We had plenty of land, but not a whole lot of cash, is how I always describe it.
I heard your father was very spoiled, Rania, by his parents. Was he spoiled?
Well, so his brothers slag him. I've heard at family occasions saying, oh, he was spoiled because he was the eldest. He used to get special attention from his mom. Dad was sort of the apple of her eye when he was growing up. I've heard lots of stories from the brothers, definitely. But she spoiled us too. She sadly passed away when I was about 4 or 5. But when I was a young child, I spent a lot of time with her, and she used to feed me. My aunt tells me that I was 2 and I was sitting in her house and she fed me 6 sausages one morning. Because she liked to spoil her children. I think his dad was the eldest. He got special treatment.
And then you became a teacher, didn't you? Yeah.
I decided to do teaching, and I immediately got a job in a primary school in Ballinacarrigy, which would be in County Westmead, but only a short distance away from my home. Then a local inspector came to me and asked me, would I like to be an inspector? They were recruiting at the time, and I said I'd give it a go. Probably the most notable thing that happened in my time as an inspector was that's how I met my wife, Marla. She was teaching, and I...
inspected her.
Yes.
Very carefully.
And ended up inviting her out for a date, which inevitably was associated with a GA event. And the rest is history, as they say.
Oh, that was great. But the GA, you were a good inter-county player, weren't you?
I wouldn't have rated myself as a great player. We did have success at St. Mel's. St. Mel's had a great record in the college's football. But when I left and when I started to teach, I got involved at a very young age in administration of the GA. And
How did you do that, and why did you do that?
By accident. Like a lot of those, to be quite frank about it. My local club, first of all, they were short of someone who would go to the county board meetings to represent the club. And they said, here's this young fellow, he's just got a job, he's going to be living locally, and he'll do a job for us. And I was involved. I was only 19 at that stage, so I went from that to taking over as secretary of the club a couple of years afterwards, and then before I knew it, I was vice chairman of the county board, and I was chairman then when I was 23.
So. Did you ever think you'd be director general of the GAA? I mean, was it something you wanted to be?
No, it wasn't, and in fact, I didn't really give it any consideration. My parents and all my family were shocked when it was announced that I had been appointed, because I hadn't discussed it with them at all, and I hadn't taken it seriously. My name had gone forward, and all the newspapers were speculating about certain people that were going to be appointed. My name didn't hit the headlines. The media weren't as good in those days as they are now. They didn't get the story, and I came up for a regular meeting because I was on the Central Council of the GA at the time, and a man came out to me and he said, follow me. He whispered to me, follow me. And I followed him into a little ante room.
Did you wonder why he was taking you?
Yes, I was wondering. And he said to me, they want you inside in the room, but don't say anything. And the head bods of the organisation were inside. And when I went in, they said that they were offering me the job. And I just was so shocked, because I was sure that it was signed and sealed at that stage. And I then had the fuss of trying to contact my family to let them know before it would all break in.
But they said they
media.
Wanted the answer from you pretty much away, didn't they?
They did. I said I would like 24 hours to tell the people in the Department of Education, because I hadn't told them anything. So I was left in the situation that they said, well, you have to say yes or no tonight.
This was Dorania, as a young girl, your whole life really has been steeped in the GAA because of your dad and his role within it.
Yeah, we just grew up and it was normal to be in Croke Park every weekend during the championship, and then up and down the country during the league. We'd be in maybe Tyrone one Sunday and Kerry another Sunday, and we were just kids running around a lot of the time. We used to enjoy going into the clubhouse for sandwiches at half time and watching the game. But like we had such an insight and such freedom around Croke Park in many ways, especially before it was regenerated and with the new buildings. But we were just let loose, really. And I remember on Sunday sitting in Dad's office before the game, eating jam donuts that the security guard Robert used to give us. And I remember playing football on the pitch in Croke Park with some of the other children of some of the other people that worked in the GAA, and that was lovely. You know, it really was, to have that access and just to feel part of it, because the GAA is such a close-knit organisation. There's a real family feel to it, and wherever you go in the world you'll always find GAA people.
But no. As a result of it, I must say, I always described myself as an absentee parent in those days, that Marla was very much left to bring the children to their sporting events and to bring them to whatever they had to go to. I was always otherwise engaged, but that's one of the pleasures and one of the disadvantages of working for a voluntary organisation.
It is an extraordinary organisation. Mm. We all know how successful it is. Why do you think it is still so enduringly huge in this country, Liam?
A lot of people ask that question. And I think the GAA has been very good. Very often over the years, the GAA was criticised and people said that the GAA was very slow to change. But in fact, when you analyse it, the GAA have been very good at keeping up with the times. And as times change, they are in tune with the New Ireland. And if they were out of tune, they would not still be popular. And I think that has been the critical element for them, that they have been very canny, if you don't mind me using the word, in terms of knowing that there are times when you just have to change. And to their eternal credit, I think that's why they've kept up with the times.
I think it's the sport itself, though, because it's just so enjoyable to watch. Yeah. Like we were talking about, I'm living over in London at the moment and I didn't get home for the football final. So I was in a pub in London in Kilburn, an old Irish GAA area as well, and I was watching the game, and the Liverpool-Manchester United game was on first, and they switched over the tellies and the Donegal-Mayo game came on, and there was such a difference between the two sports. When you watch them back to back like that, the GAA is just more exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's so fast and quick.
An interesting thing, Doran, you told me as well, you get it hard to believe this, the person who owned the pub over there in London happened to be from Donegal. So what did he do? Half time in the game, everyone got free sandwiches.
Sandwiches and chips and wedges and the whole shebang. It was great.
That's what's so great about it. During your reign, Liam, obviously you presided over a lot of change. What, if I asked you what would the lowest moment have been of your tenure and maybe your biggest achievement or your highest moment?
Well, I take the second one first. I think probably I always felt that the regeneration of Croke Park and completing the redevelopment of Croke Park was going to be a huge project and a very worrying one in terms of the cost. And we could have, you know, gone for a cheap solution, but we decided that that wasn't what the GAA wanted. And we were just very lucky that the government did appreciate what was being done and that we got very significant support from the government. Both Albert Reynolds and Bertie Ahern, both of them were very supportive, as were all the political parties, I'd have to say, in fairness of what the GAA was doing. And at that stage, they had to make, I talked about faith in Doranya earlier, they had to make an act of faith in the GAA, that the GAA would deliver, and that if the time came that Croke Park were needed for other sports, and I'm sure that was in their minds, and a lot of people said they should have put a condition to giving the grant aid to Croke Park. But if they insisted on a condition, it just wouldn't have happened. And so they felt, well, things will change and the GAA will change, and it did. So it worked out well from everyone's point of view. That would be my high point. My lowest point in terms of the GAA was probably, I was very down after the 83 All-Ireland football final, because it was a very, very controversial final, one of the most controversial in my time in Croke Park. It was the famous day that Dublin finished with 13 players but still won the game against Galway. But it was a very, very wet day, and we almost had a serious Hillsborough-type accident at the back of Hill 16 at the end of the game. And in fact, that was the changer, if you like, that brought home to me that we just had to do something about Croke Park, that it was too old-fashioned for coping with modern crowds. Both of my high and my low, if you like, would be related to the stadium to some extent.
We're going to take a piece of music. You both love it, but Liam, it's Bear McGurk. Tell me about this song.
Well, the song, the words were written by the Shaoch, Padraig O'Shukru, who happens to be a granduncle of Maura and my wife. So it obviously has a family connection. Everyone associates the Shaoch, of course, with them, Baile Shukina and Jimin Mhara Haig, who was the great character in the book. But the Shaoch wrote Barma Gurucht, and there's a version sung by Shane of Begley, who's one of the well-known Begley family from Dingle as well. So just love Dingle and everything about it.
Mom's very proud of him as a granduncle. She has a lot of stories to tell, and so does Granddad Patrick. So it'll be nice to hear this song.
Oh, let's listen to it now.
A kind coral, a course in Knaster. Is leaf and vole down the dawn of our
Seamus O'Begley and Steve Cooney there with Bear McGurucht. You seem very close, actually, as a father and daughter. Do you think the experience of the meningitis changed your relationship or not, Dorania?
It's difficult to answer because that was just part of both our lives, and that's just the way it's gone. So you don't know. It's the same with me even when I talk about my life and I say, would I be doing this had I not had the illness? And you just don't know. It's just what we all went through. But it probably did mean that the family had to learn to maybe be more open about certain things or talk about certain things. Every single one of us, it impacted us. So it probably did change us, but we don't know how because it was just part of our lives.
That's it. We just grew into it.
Did it change you as a person, Liam?
I think it did change my attitude. There's no doubt about that. I sort of hinted at that earlier when I said, you know, that everything had been successful in our family, as it were, and that it's only when you have a setback that it does change you, and it does make you think about your own mortality as well. And I remember Maura saying to me, why would our child be taken? Why wouldn't it be one of us? Mm. You do begin to think about yourself, and you think about life in a different way as well. And only a few years after Dorania had her illness, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and got it diagnosed in time, and have had no ill effects ever since.
You look the picture of health
but,
now.
Well, thank goodness I haven't had any setbacks.
You mentioned faith earlier. Look, at the time when Dorania was ill, do you have a strong faith, and did that help you at that time?
I'd like to think that I do, and also more, both of us would have had a strong faith, and we also had a great reliance on each other, and we said we're going to pull through this together, because Dorania was very much inclined to leave things to us. She said, whatever the decisions are, you know, you go ahead and do it. And as she said, Mam was the fighter, and there was quite a bit of fighting to be done about one aspect or another of treatments, and of afterwards then of limbs and replacement limbs. And it's an aspect that isn't sort of appreciated, but a pair of hands lasts only a year, and a pair of legs maximum of 2 years. So there's a lot of work in adapting to new limbs, apart from the cost and all the other factors that are involved with it. And so I think all of that experience has helped and has moulded our relationship as well.
The cost is something that worries me, actually, because it's becoming more and more difficult to get the limbs every year just because of cutbacks. And I'm still in my, well, I'm late 20s now, obviously, but it's something that worries me because I'm still going to need them in 20, maybe 30, maybe 40 years' time.
70 years, Dorania.
But it's just one of those things that does worry me because they're my lifeline. Mm. I wouldn't be able to, I can, like I said, it's the type of disability that you can easily get on with your life if you're given the right tools and if you're given the limbs to let you do it. But often they get so worn down that I end up getting cuts on my skin and being in pain. And the worst part is when you end up being in bed because you can't walk because of a problem. And that's when you feel, you know, you can fight through things and say, I'm accepting it and I'm getting on with my life. But it's horrible being in pain. That's when you feel, oh, this is just not fair. And you see your friends getting on with normal life. And it is something that worries me in one way when I think about the future and I don't know what's ahead of me. But I think the best thing you can just do is live in the moment in a situation like that and take every year as it comes. Because every year has led into the next. And you look back, when we talk about my illness, you look back and it's so long ago now, it's over 12 years ago. But in one way, it only feels like yesterday, and in one way, it feels like another lifetime ago.
You seem such a positive person, but do you sometimes, in your quieter moments away from your father and your mom and stuff, get annoyed that it happened to you?
No, with us.
I don't like having to rely on people. I really don't. And that's something that frustrates me, because I'm quite stubborn, I suppose, in certain ways. I don't like having to ask for help about things. So if it comes to a situation where I do, that does annoy me. I don't think I do really get down, only in a normal way, the way everybody does. And sometimes when you feel bad about something, you sort of take extra and go, and why? I also have to cope with this and I also have to cope with that, but not any way differently to anybody else my own age or anybody else in general. It's just an extra thing I have to carry around in life.
Do you have faith like your parents?
I do. You have to have faith in yourself and in your family. You have to know that there's something ahead, there's a reason for a living. And I do have quite a strong faith. I do. I think you have to. I think you have to know that there's a purpose and there's something else.
But there's the other aspect to it too, Dorania, that I think is important. And it's a question we often asked, why?
Yeah.
Why Dorania? Why was she the one who was hit by meningitis? And why our family? And you have to say that's a decision taken by the man above. And I think if you don't believe that, it must be a lot more difficult to be positive about what has happened to you.
In general, do you know what? You just get on day to day. You just get up in the morning, you go to work and you live your life. You're not even aware. You don't even think about it. And sometimes when I tell the story, it's like I'm telling the story of somebody else. It doesn't even feel like my own story. Yet it did happen and I did go through it. So it's still very much part of me. But you can't be conscious of it all the time and be thinking of it all the time, because then you'll just never get on with the normal things.
And it was good, because years ago you made the decision to go public, didn't you, and make people aware of meningitis. Was that a big decision to make, to do that?
We didn't think it was at the time. We felt that by going public and saying that it had happened, that it was going to, first of all, make people more aware of the dangers of meningitis, and secondly, that in any way we could help in terms of fundraising.
I think it's the least you can do, because I think we were so struck by the disease. I think the least you can do is maybe make other people more vigilant about it. And like we said initially, it's all about time with meningitis, and if you can spot the symptoms, because they're very common in, it's most common in babies and then teenagers and then the elderly. And I think if people know what the symptoms are, and they're available on the Meningitis Research Foundation website, then they're just more ready, and they're ready to jump into action when the time comes. And it's a sort of a twofold thing, because the strain of meningitis I got was quite severe, and in one way I don't want to scaremonger people and say this is what's going to happen. But on the other side of things, I always saw meningitis as being a life or death situation. I didn't think people could be left with disabilities. And I've met a lot of people who've been left quite severely disabled by meningitis. And, you know, it's actually nice to know that other people have gone through something similar and come out the other end. Because you can, I mentioned this earlier, you can sometimes feel alone with something like that.
True.
And now you're in London, but you're coming back at the end of this year, aren't you, Dorania?
Hopefully so. I am. I'm doing bits and bobs of work still in London, and then we'll see what the future holds. It's difficult to know in a time like this, but I'm hoping to come back the end of Christmas.
Maybe come back here as a sports presenter.
Oh, that would be nice. That would be nice.
Is there life after being the DG of the GAA?
Oh, very much, very much. I'm quite involved. I'm a chairperson of Fergus na Gaeilge, which is a north-south body set up under the Anglo-Irish Agreement. That keeps me going a couple of days a week, and I'm involved with a few other pieces, especially at parish level. I'm involved in a lot of parish committees of one sort or another.
Still very much part of the local club, Dunamore Ashburn, as well.
And involved with Dunamore Ashburn as well.
But he's still not resting on his laurels. I've rarely seen him watching television or with his feet up. You're always busy.
Do you ring him up for advice?
I think myself and both my brothers, Angus and Fionn, would both agree that Dad's just, he always gives sound advice and he thinks things through. He's a good person to call.
That's a lovely praise. We're the end to the show, actually. Well, we're going out in a piece of music to Ronya, Jessica Ware, Wildest Moments. You love this?
This reminds me of the Paralympics very much. It was used a lot over different montages from the Olympics and Paralympics, and it's just a nice song.
Ronya, I've loved having you here. Congratulations on your work in Channel 4, and I hope you come back here soon. Liam, keep up all your great work. My thanks on sound today to Caro Hare, to my producer Eileen Heron. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we'll go out listening to Jessica Ware and Wildest Moments. Baby,
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.